Welcome back, boys and girls, for another special edition of the Michael Deacon Program. Joining me in a moment, we have New Blood. My guest will be Emily Moyer. She is a multifaceted professional serving as a nutrition consultant, life coach, and podcast host with a knack for blending unique life experiences, intuitive research, and analytical approach. She explores unconventional ideas from various domains, including alternative cyberspace, the arts, health, sports, and human development. Her podcasts offer fresh perspectives and concepts for our ever-evolving understanding. Now, without further ado, let's get down to business and bring in Emily. And join me right now, live and direct, is Emily Moyer. How's it going?
I am recovering from something disgusting and flu-like, but I'm happy to be here with you. I've been in the house for 2 days, so I'm bored and looking forward to a chat to bring me out of that boredom.
Well, don't threaten me with a good time. Let me know what disgusting, vile thing you are going through. I mean, the audience loves things that are, you know, unsavory at times. So hit it. Let me know what's going on.
So I traveled the last week for work and to Washington and D.C. and back, like, really quick. It's like they're on Monday, back on Tuesday. And I don't get sick very often, but when I do, it usually happens to coincide with air travel, right? And so I got back on Tuesday night late. And then about Thursday, halfway through work, I started to feel a little funny. And I had... I was committed to, you know, working the Food and Wine Festival here in Austin. I make craft cocktails, right? And so I, and it was a lot of physical labor. So Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, all while with the flu, I had to power through that. So I think it was just like your classic flu, which is, you know, to make some, you know, body aches and fevery kind of stuff and a little bit of congestion and throat stuff.
Right.
Nothing like having to do hard physical labor through that. But I figured if I have any karma left to burn through, it got burned through this weekend. So like, I'm good to go for whatever's coming our way.
In other words, you contracted COVID and now you are dying.
Right. You got it. Exactly. Something like that.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad you're okay, and I'm glad you're here. I know we've been meaning to do this program together for quite some time. And Emily, I'm so glad you're here. I'm excited that you're here. We needed a female voice here, a very energetic female that's not afraid to speak her mind. And usually we get females around here, obviously, but they're very shy though. Too shy.
Well, I'm definitely not shy.
You're not. You're definitely not.
Sometimes when somebody calls me on the phone, like a telemarketer or something, they'll say, good evening, Mr. Moyer, because my voice is deeper than they're expecting.
Oh, my.
Right? So I'm definitely not shy. And I suppose you could call it a female voice, though deeper than the
average. I mean, I wouldn't say that. I mean, when I'm talking to you, when I first heard you here, I didn't think I was talking to a guy.
All right, well, good.
No. I mean, I would tell you I'm that kind of an asshole.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, while it's definitely predominantly men in the alternative, whatever we're calling this now. What are we calling ourselves?
I'm not even sure. I'm not a part of anything. I'm not really part of any group, per se. I'm on the outside. I'm on the outside looking in, just like you.
Yeah. You know, but in the alternative information, conspiracy, whatever community this thing is, it has been like largely male. There's always been some female around like for a long time, right. And still they're largely relegated to like the health or the feelings portion of alternative thought. And you know, I think, you know, that is also breaking. You know, there's definitely, you know, other people than myself who are out there like talking about pretty weird cutting edge kind of stuff. But probably not nearly as many as, you know, as have opinions about it. And, right. And hopefully that will change, continue to change going forward. I never think about that kind of stuff. Sure. Like, I'm always just saying and doing whatever I'm saying I'm doing. And if people like it, great. And if not, no. You know, sometimes people will point out to me and I can look back in hindsight that like, oh, like something that I did, like I was the only girl doing it, or, you know, it was amazing that I got to do that because everyone, I don't think about that when I'm doing it. You know, but yes, other people have pointed out to me that there should be more female voices in this arena. And I just think that there should be more interesting voices in this arena. And
oh, if those I agree.
Female, that's great.
I agree. I agree 100%. And for those who don't know, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you kind of jumped into this realm here. And by the way, again, welcome to the program. We love it when it's the first time for anyone here. Usually, go ahead.
I love being on shows for the first time. That's like one of my favorite things, is to go on someone's show I haven't been on before. So
I know that's why I love this, and I'm introducing you to a whole new audience. They have no idea who you are. They barely know who I am. So I'm glad you're here. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Emily.
So I grew up in Los Angeles, California. I was, you know, there's a couple of interests. I think there's like a few unique things about me. I was a competitive gymnast, and that's, I started in gymnastics when I was 2 years old. And the other thing that I started when I was two was I was involved in Hollywood, in commercials and television shows and movies. From the time that I was two, really until I was about six, when my love for gymnastics superseded any appeal that the Hollywood thing had for me, I then picked back up with some of the Hollywood stuff later in my teenage years, more as a stunt double using my gymnastics ability. So those are two things that I was sort of involved in from the time I was very young that most people aren't. As well, I come from, I guess I'm starting to appreciate more and more as I get older, a pretty weird or interesting family. And then as, you know, in my early 20s, I became deeply enmeshed in dance music and rave culture. Mm. And those three things, I think, gave me kind of a unique set of experiences and then perspective as I began to delve into conspiracy, other versions of reality, counter politics, all of that kind of stuff, you know, sort of in my mid-20s. For my whole life, I was a little bit weird. Like, I didn't like the same things that other people liked. I also wasn't, like, the super weirdest. You know what I mean? There was, like, a specific, you know, something with a sort of a different sparkle would always catch my eye. And
you weren't like the goth kid in high school, were you?
No, I wasn't the goth kid, though. Like, I flirted with that kind of thing. Like, I liked some of those people and I liked some of that music, but I didn't like the whole thing, right? Like, I kind of, you know, certain aspects of certain subcultures or countercultures or undercultures would grab my attention, and I would kind of explore that for a bit and then sort of take the part I liked, leave the rest behind, and like move on and explore something else. And I sort of put together like a patchwork quilt of lots of things that appealed to me or that I liked or that I was good at or that sort of caught my attention in some kind of way that was different than everything else, right?
Right.
And I was also the kind of kid who, from the time I was was a little bit suspicious. Like, I wouldn't say that I was like a conspiracy theorist from day one in terms of like the way we think about it, but I always felt like there was something that my parents weren't telling me.
You.
Or something that the grown-ups were not telling me. And that thing that they were not telling me would explain the difference between what was, you know, we were told was going on and what was really going on, or what I thought was going on, but what was actually going on. And so I was always that kid who like didn't want to go to sleep because I thought that whatever the secret thing that was happening was happened, you know, after the kids went to sleep, or I always peeked where I wasn't supposed to, or, you know, that kind of stuff. Right. So I was always somewhat suspicious, and I liked mysteries and, you know, that kind of thing. You know, so
you're pretty normal, in other words.
I mean, on some, for me, like that was my life. Like that was how I grew up. It seemed normal to me. As I progressed through, I always recognized the difference first between myself and the other kids, right, and then myself and the other teenagers, and then myself and the other people I worked with or adults. And now whenever I meet someone for the first time, like they will, not every person I meet, but anybody I have a lengthy exchange with of any that has any meaning to it at all, one of the first things they'll say back to me is how interesting or unusual my story is, or my perspective is, or my background is, or my family sounds, or whatever it is, right? And so I am now clear that there is like something unique about my set of circumstances. But I think the thing that is most unique is sort of the angle or the perspective that I have developed on myself, on my life, on the reality that I find myself in, and then the way I describe that to other people. And I think that might have been a knack for storytelling that I picked up from my grandmother, who could, you know, make, you know, she could tell us about the trip that, you know, she and my grandfather had to the auto club to pick up a brochure and make it sound interesting, right? So I think that I developed some way of sort of, you know, I wouldn't even say it's like embellishing it. I would just say like learning to notice the interesting things going on around you that most people miss, so you can make any sort of experience full and detailed, right?
Right.
So yeah, so, you know, I can be a little bit theatrical. I'm definitely high energy and, you know, very physical. And I've also looked into a lot of things. I've, you know, I don't do as much deep research now as I used to, just because I don't have the time to do it. But by this point, I've sort of developed research methods that allow me to get to what I'm looking for pretty quickly. But I certainly had a number of years where I spent a lot of time in every rabbit hole. And my memory is pretty good, so I'm able to pull from a lot of different arenas.
Right.
And even when there's something that I've looked into that, like, I don't agree with, or like, I don't think that's quite true, there might be something about it that strikes my interest. So I store it away anyway. And then like later it does like connect in some way to something else. Like even if like most of the rabbit hole was a limited hangout, there was like one painting on the wall that was like a clue to the rabbit hole I should really be in. And so when I find myself there, you know, then I can refer back to that or whatever it is. You know, so I have a lot to say about a lot of different things, and then I connect things in sort of unusual ways. Like I probably see connections where other people don't. And it allows me to pursue less traveled paths. And then when it pans out, you know, I can go back and explain that to people and, you know, in a way that is something new or different or interesting to them. And I think probably that's what people in this realm anyway have come to get to know me for, is that I just have a different take, a different perspective.
Right.
A different sort of way that I thread what I refer to at this point, so that people can understand that as either like my own choose your own adventure path or my synchromysticism. Like I do it a little different than everyone else, but I've become good at explaining it.
Understood. And for those who don't know, you can also check out Emily here at just by going to YouTube and typing in her name, Emily Moyer, and you'll see that she has a lot of interviews, a lot of shows out there, and the latest one you did was a few weeks ago, if I recall. Yeah, that was a few weeks ago, and yes, you're obviously busy. No one has enough time in their lives to really be doing this all the damn time. So I understand how that goes. And, you know, earlier you were mentioning this realm, and it's pretty much male-dominated for sure. And I'm sure you get plenty of emails from strange men, I'm sure. You got to.
Not as many as some of my colleagues do. Let's put it that way. I've gotten my fair share of strange emails, but, you know, probably not as many as I used to get. And not as many, I get lots of emails, right?
Sure.
But generally, most of them are range from respectful to interesting or whatever.
So they're not that creepy then, in other words.
I've gotten some creepy ones over the years, but not as many super creepies as some of my colleagues get. Which is just fine with me. Like, I'm perfectly happy. I feel satisfied with the number of creepy emails.
Right.
I've got.
Well, that's a good thing. And here's the crazy part. And I know a lot of guys are probably going to get angry at me for saying this and being honest and telling the truth here, but someone's got to do it. And I say this to like every female I know that's on social media, that any female really that posts her photos up anywhere. You're always going to generate at least 4 to 5 weird stalkers out there.
Right.
It's the craziest thing. I know people hate to talk about that, but it's true. It's goddamn true, Emily.
Yeah. No, I mean, I definitely had my fair share of weird stuff, but I actually feel like pretty fortunate. You know, when you choose to do this, which I choose to do.
Right.
It comes along with some stuff, you were mentioning my YouTube channel. I still post occasional shows on YouTube, but I stopped. You know, I used to do the posting, you know, half of every show I did on YouTube. And several months back, I moved to actually doing most of my content just for my supporters and then doing a public show on YouTube occasionally for a variety of reasons. I am doing this all the time. I produce like an exorbitant amount of content. I have many shows I do with other co-hosts and different ideas and themes that I play with on the different shows. But I found that sort of the YouTube thing had like grown, you know, I'd kind of like run my number with YouTube in terms of like, you know, every time you put a show up, right, you're risking the wrath of the YouTube strikes and algorithms, this and that. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time and I kind of have a following that is into what I'm doing and they've been with me for a long time and they're pretty consistent. And every once in a while, someone new comes or someone old leaves. I wasn't really like growing anymore. Mm. I've been weirder and weirder in my content. So it's more and more niche. You know, so every once in a while I'll do a public show, but I am creating a ton of content, even though I do other work, you know, and I share a lot of myself on the show. Like sharing my insights and my thoughts and my personal experiences has always been a part of my content. In the beginning, like, I think I didn't know how to do that right. The years, I've figured out how to do that. But along with that, it's just my nature. Like, what I know is my experience. And that's the only thing I can really report 100% accurately on. I talk about all the other stuff, but I talk about it from my perspective. And that I do it, it's sharing a lot of personal stories. And some people don't like that. Like some people, and I think it's fair, some people think that that's like, all she ever does is talk about herself. That's fine. Like, you don't have to listen. I'm not talking about myself because I think I'm more important than anyone else. I'm talking about my experiences because they're the ones that I know.
Right.
And there's some things that I've experienced that people come back to me and say, you know, that thing you talked about, that happened to me, and I have never heard anybody else say that. So thank you for saying that, so I don't think I'm crazy, right? And also, like, you know, I've learned how to share my stories a little bit from listening to you, but it took me a while to get good at it, and some people still don't like it. And so I realized at a certain point that the things that interest me and the way that I share is not for everybody. It's for a select group of people.
Right.
Right. And that's
the best part. It's hard for some people to realize that and get it through their heads that no matter what, there's always going to be a group of people out there that are just going to hate everything that you say. They're going to just, they're not going to like anything about you. So it's better to, I guess, dance on eggshells than to walk around them.
Yeah, right. I just kind of figured out like what I was doing and why I was doing it. And some people will like it and some people don't. There's also some people who like listened to everything I've ever done.
And right.
Like, the stalkers. As well. Yeah. Right. But, you know, when you do share as much personally as I do, there are certain things that go along with that. There are sort of consequences for that. And at a certain point, I just decided that I was going to do most of my content for my supporters. And, you know, that's the path that I have chosen. And it also allows me to explore ideas that I'm not certain about yet, right? Without having this public record on YouTube of everybody saying, well, you said this and you were wrong about that and you were wrong about that. Well, I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just wanting to explore it. And sometimes you can better explore an idea if for the period of time that you're looking into it, you are suspending disbelief. When you're watching the movie, you know, you enjoy it more if you're not trying to tear it apart and deconstruct it from the moment you say go. Like, watch the whole thing, take it in as it is. And then you can go back and rewatch it and break it down and analyze it for clues or this, that, or the other thing. But if you're trying to explore something and you're worried as you're going through the whole time about making mistakes, it limits how deeply you can really explore that topic, like how many angles you can see it from. So, you know, when you're on YouTube and you make mistakes, right? Like, it's out there forever. And I've chosen to free my, I don't really care that much about making mistakes, but I have found that I can explore much stranger topics and much more deeply when I choose to do that, like just on my own private platform.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's a different way of doing it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And Emily, you mentioned going to raves. How old were you when you were attending these festivals, rather?
So I got into
breakdancing
as a child. When my dad took me during the 1984 Olympics, he took me down to Venice Beach because the the marathon or like some portion of like one of the events was like the marathon or whatever, right? It was passing through Venice Beach, so it was like, okay, we can go down there and you can watch that part for free without having to have a ticket to one of the events. And when we went down there, there was breakdancers on the boardwalk there.
On the pier.
I had never seen that before.
Yeah. Okay.
I was already, the only time I had seen it once before, I had seen it in the movie Flashdance, right?
Right.
And I liked that, but I was about 6 or 7 when Flashdance came out. And though I was already a gymnast, I was at a certain level, but by the time my dad took me in 1984, my skill level was higher. So it was kind of like, oh, well, I can do that stuff now. So I turned the living room of our house into like a place where I practiced spinning on my back, spinning on my head and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
That wasn't really what we were allowed to do at the gym. Right. So that always appealed to me. And I always liked dance style music. I always liked music that had like a 4-on-the-floor beat and a lot of rhythm that way. But I didn't actually go to a rave until
a little later,
in the mid to late 90s. Some people that I worked with at a coffee place I worked at in Malibu, and then later a pizza place I worked at in Brentwood. They went to raves, and I went along a couple of times, and I'll be honest with you, like, sure. It didn't quite match for me, right? Like, I didn't quite get it. There would be moments where, like, I sort of felt like what the big deal was.
It's,
right?
It's a lot of house music, though. I mean, I'm sure your head might have been hurting after all that.
So when I first started going, I went to some drum and bass parties. I went to some house stuff. And, like, I remember being at this party on a mountaintop overlooking Los Angeles, and I had taken an ecstasy pill. And DJ, like, dropped the bass so deeply that, like, the whole mountain shook, and I felt it through my body. And I remember really liking that, right? And I went to some parties, and I enjoyed myself. And I had always enjoyed dancing, you know, obviously I told you, but I was kind of introverted socially that way. Often gymnasts kind of are, even though, like, I might be an extrovert talking in terms of, like, dancing out in public.
Right. Different story.
Yeah. And then when I moved to Austin, I moved here. I took a coaching job, coaching gymnastics, and I was going to the University of Texas. I had dropped in and out of school a couple of times. I, you know, was wanting to meet people, and I was like, well, I had gone to some of these parties and some of these people are nice, so I guess I'll go to the local music store and pick up a flyer and I'll go to a party, and, you know, whatnot. And as soon as I started going to parties here in Austin, I started meeting a lot of people. It was much, I don't know, like, I was just more sort of socially, I fit in here better. And one party early on that I went to in Austin, I remember, like, I don't know what happened, but suddenly I was, like, dancing in a way that I had never danced before.
Uh-oh.
And, like, I had this, like, download of information that, like, was kind of about the history of this music. And it kind of hit me on sort of a cellular level. And from that night forward, I was obsessed with dancing. I was obsessed with techno music and house music. And I understood intuitively, like, where this music came from, why it was important. Like, weirdly, like,
really?
I knew actual facts about the history of the music.
Well, Emily, you got to tell me, what did you take?
I took ecstasy.
Took ecstasy, and you got this download of all this information.
I mean, I had taken it before, right? I had taken ecstasy before. I had enjoyed the parties, but, like,
Not this, though.
I was at the Austin City Music Hall. And I was standing in this one area of the Austin City Music Hall that from there forward became, like, my favorite place to dance. And it was almost like energy was streaming into me. You know, I particularly liked that the music that was playing that night. Right. And I don't know, something grabbed me. And if you talk to people who who get deeply into dance music, it will be like that. They went to their first rave or whatever it is, and one night just changed their whole life. And then they were really into that music. And, you know, that was for me. It didn't happen at the very first rave, but it happened pretty early on. And from there, I was deeply, every weekend going to multiple parties. The music for me and the drugs for sure were part of it.
Right.
But it started this pretty deep, like, internal exploration, you know, and psychological sort of analysis of myself.
And how old were you at this point, by the way? I'm sorry to interrupt.
I was actually 25.
25. Okay.
A little bit older than a lot of, like, most people, like, get knee deep in a little younger than that. Like, I had been going for a little bit and, you know, whatever it is. But at 25 in 1999, I had a life-changing experience with the music.
Wild.
And from there, I was sold on that music, and it became part of my life. And but for me, it wasn't just going to the party and enjoying the music and taking drugs and socializing, though I was doing all of those things. I fell in love with this really deep exploration of my psyche, and then the sort of one-to-one comparison of that which was going on inside of me to things that were going on outside of me, and seeing that correlation, right? That as within, so without, as above, you know, as below, so above, or whatever it is. Like, I enjoyed playing with that, and I started to have sort of some, you know, I guess what you would call like a little bit of like out of body experiences or sort of dissociative experiences. When I say dissociative, I don't mean that in the way that you think that you normally think of it. What I mean is the ability to like observe myself, to be outside of myself and watch myself.
I understand exactly what you mean. Yeah.
For me, that was like part of that was I danced in the circle a lot because I was a break dancer. Right. And I had a couple of interesting experiences on acid where I could, standing on the side of the circle, watching myself dancing in the circle.
Oh, I know. I've been there before a time or two. You know, I've taken acid all by accident, by the way. I have no idea how it entered my body. Let's put it that way. Yes, it was all an accident. I've had a number of accidents, to put it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's very, you know, in the beginning, like, so I started with taking, you know, ecstasy, and then I got into acid, and I think acid was much more interesting to me than ecstasy was.
You learn more.
You learn more, and at a certain point, I kind of stopped taking ecstasy, and I was just taking acid, and then a year or two later, I was kind of, like, done with acid, but then I tried mushrooms, and mushrooms became, my favorite.
Yeah.
And they still are to this day. Like I do a lot of my, you know, exploration or just sort of, I don't do them frequently, but when I do them, I glean a lot of information that I then spend the next 6 months or 8 months or year till the next time I do it, like really mining that, that information that I got for all that it was kind of, you know, worth. And I really enjoyed sort of the places that I would go in my head, the things that I would learn, the, you know, all the visuals. Like I would close my eyes and see all kinds of stuff on the back of my eyelids that, you know, over the years have turned out to be actually really valuable, high level esoteric information at sometimes, right? So for me, that was probably the part about it that I like, though I enjoy being at the party with everybody.
Sure.
You know, that was the part that I was really addicted to. And then as the years went on, I left Austin and I moved several places. At a certain point, you know, I was mostly back in Los Angeles, which is where I'm from. And, you know, ultimately that's where I've done most of my partying and dance music kind of stuff. And at a certain point, my life became very complicated, and I did have about 10 or 15 years where I was deeply into hard drug use.
Whoa, shit. Okay.
And that coincided.
You left behind this world of music for a while. This was Emily at 25, listening to this. She was listening to this at age 25 on acid. I can't even imagine. Holy shit. Anywho.
You know, so I was still going to parties, but my life became complicated. This coincided with having poked a hole in the curtain and really starting to realize that the world was not as
it is. And Emily, let me just cut you off right there. Okay, tell me about when did the hard drugs come in exactly? What was going through Emily at the time when this all occurred?
So I had one brief year of hard drug use when I was 20, right? Mm-hmm. I had like stumbled into using cocaine in a very strange way. It was over pretty quickly and moved on from that. And then when I was living here in Austin, during those party years here in Austin, some friends that I went to parties with used meth, and I was introduced to meth.
Oh, recreational stuff. I see. It was in like okay. I thought perhaps you were going through something personal that sort of led you down the hard drug use, but now it seems like this was just a recreational phase.
No, it wasn't recreational. It was introduced to me socially.
Right. Yeah.
For a while it was on and off, and then...
I meant social, recreational, sorry.
Yeah, and then at a certain point, like I was a tweaker, right? And that, you know, about, you know, 26 years old until like 39 or 40, on and off for those 15 years, I was a drug user, and that sort of colored everything else. And that coincided with the deep dives into the conspiracy realm, the metaphysical realm, and all of this kind of stuff. And
was it the meth that got you into conspiracies?
I wouldn't say exactly that it was the meth. I'd say that it was the two things were happening simultaneously.
That's a hard word. Trust me, I know.
The meth provided the fuel for amount and depth of research that I did, and it definitely numbed me and allowed me to. I've looked at some pretty weird and pretty difficult stuff,
right?
And it definitely, I mean, I sometimes would be up 26 hours a day, so I had plenty of time to research.
Oh yeah.
And I also was able to just power through really hard material that I think if I hadn't been anesthetized by the drugs would have been so damaging to my emotions and psychology that, like, I wouldn't have been able to continue. Like, no sane, sober person would have been able to spend a number of hours looking at some of the disturbing things that I was reading and studying and finding out about without falling apart. Now, I was falling apart in a different way, but I powered through all of that stuff, right, in that sort of condition. But it also, you know, it was kind of interesting the thing that really poked it open for me was I had this class I was taking. I was back in school in Los Angeles, and I took this class called The Sociology of Drug Use.
Mm.
As part of the class, there was two things that came up that sort of poked at me and made me, you know, like dig deeper. And that was, I learned about the Dark Alliance, which is the Gary Webb, Ricky Ross, Iran-Contra crack cocaine thing.
He's been on the program, by the way. Freeway Ricky Ross? Right.
Yeah.
Many moons ago.
That was a pivotal
shift for you.
Pivotal shift. That was in 2005. The teacher had like the original newspaper articles written by Gary Webb, which at that point had been suppressed. Right now they're freely available again, but for a period of time, like, they had disappeared copies of those newspapers.
This is true, yes.
Didn't have the level of internet that we have now. And that really stuck with me. And that was when I first learned about, oh, it's interesting how the government creates the problems that they then later are pretending to try to solve.
That's right.
The connection between geopolitics and street crime or drugs or weapons in the United States. Like, I really started to have my opinion of the government shift from, like, you know, something that is there to, if not help, at the very least, like, keep things under control, to, oh no, they're there to actually cause problems.
Right.
To control people, not to help anything, right? So that, and then another part of the course, there was a small section on MKUltra. And of course, it was, this course was only taught for one semester, and then the teacher was fired. So I think she taught us some things maybe she wasn't supposed to. It was a very interesting course, but this part on MKUltra, it didn't go super deep. It was the stuff that, you know, people are allowed to know. Oh, you know, they drugged people, men in whorehouses, you know, gave them acid and then interrogated them. And, you know, oh, it stopped after the church committee discovered it in the 70s. It was the basic stuff. But when I heard the term MKUltra, it felt all very familiar to me. And I instinctively knew that what was being told to me in this course was not the whole story. And so I started really digging into and researching MKUltra, which has been the thing that I have probably spent the most time with as a researcher and a, you know, presenter, is sort of the lesser known and deeper aspects of those types of projects and programs. So then that hole had been poked through. But during that time was also when my drug use was increasing. So those two things coincided.
Right.
And at that time, I was going to a lot of parties, but I didn't have as many friends in the party scene in LA as I did here. So it became a very solitary experience. I wasn't really socializing. I was just going to parties, being on drugs and losing myself in my own mind while I was dancing with the music.
Damn.
And thinking about these things that I was learning and researching, but sort of using that that experience of sound and light and dancing and movement to, like, you know, sort of explore all those things from different perspectives, not just looking at documents, right? And I started to really develop some unique angles on how all of that stuff worked, both in terms of the way the projects were run, but also in terms of the way they were able to keep them secret or keep people right. confused about what they were based on how people see things. I did this for many, many years, and it was really a part of developing my unique perspective, which some people will say can't be trusted because drug use was involved in it. But what's weird is lots of other people who didn't do drugs, who've done deep research, have come to the same conclusion. They just got there a different way, right?
That's
and
right.
also, where lots of people get stuck and can't go farther, some weird little idea when I would think about it when I was on drugs will give me a clue as to where else I can go looking for information. And there I will often return the information that you can't find when you do it the traditional way. You know, so there's, I don't regret, I've been clean for 8 years from hard drugs. I still enjoy a psychedelic experience here or there, but I don't regret those years because I got to see things from a different angle than most people get to see them.
And that's the same view that the elite use today, by the way. They are all yeah. on drugs, and you have to sometimes do them to understand the enemy.
Yeah, I mean, I have a different idea. I probably have a different opinion on what drugs are and why they're illegal and what they actually do than most people. But it's exactly what you said.
They're all tools, right?
We live in a multidimensional reality, and there are different realities that are, you know, basically adherent to different frequency bands, right? And if you can resonate with a specific frequency, you can experience that version of reality. And one of the ways you change the frequency you resonate at is by using drugs. There are other ways as well, right? But, like, you know, let's just say that there's a different reality that exists at certain number of hertz. And then you can also find a substance that takes your frequency to that number of hertz.
Yeah.
Right?
A shortcut.
Then you can experience that. And I think that there's, you know, realities that are based around frequencies. There's realities that are based around specific elements, and they're all here with us. They're all coexisting, but at different angles or at different levels or layers. And drugs take you through some of those.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And by
so
the way,
I don't regret it.
Yeah, you don't regret it. I don't think you should at all. I mean, all these things were sort of laid out for you in a way, and an argument can be made if you, let's say, if you believe in free will or determination. We could talk about that for a long time, but we don't have to get into that just yet. But I was going to say, going back to what you mentioned about Gary Webb and Freeway, mm-hmm. Ricky Ross, I wanted to quickly mention, do you find it funny that people think that these things they no longer happen anymore, that this isn't going on anymore? They say, well, it happened back then, you know, things change. I always say, do you think so? The problems that we had yesterday are still here today, by the way, and things are still pretty much ran the same way they were many moons ago, except now they're a little bit more complex. You hear people arguing about you know, guns and drugs and different cartels, and you have terrorists, and it's like, well, we fund all of that, by the way. We never stopped.
Yeah. I mean, I think things look different because we have more technology, right? Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty similar template and pattern, right? I think, it's pretty much the same thing. Like, everything that will become a problem later is something that the person who will be upset about the problem later funded in the beginning, generally, right? Like, I mean, it's not, it's, you know, lots of problem, reaction, solution, or Hegelian dialectic, or whatever it is. But there's also, you know,
things evolve, but they remain the same.
Correct. It looks a little different, right? There's like the newfangled, you know, like if my grandmother was alive, she would be confused as to like where her telephone went.
Right.
But once I explains to her that this silly little thing that looks like a remote control is now the telephone and you can still call your friend and talk the same, right? So it's like, you know, it looks different and it's varied and whatnot. And obviously things have become on some level more complex just because with the proliferation of social media and the technologies that go along with it, you're able to use propaganda and the audience that is targeted by the propaganda. You're able to use their sort of interactions and their participation in it as a way to like amplify or deflect or obscure
social engineering. Yes.
From, right. And so you have to like maybe go a few layers, like you have to back up in a different way. Right. You have to either like back up and look at it from afar or really immerse yourself in it in a different way than you did before we had the level of technology and social media we have now. But at the end of the day, what Gary Webb and Freeway Ricky Ross went through is still happening. It's still happening.
Absolutely.
And more people are falling for it now than fell for it then.
Absolutely. And you're someone who believes widely in synchronicities. And I just wanted to quickly add and throw this one in there for you. But do you feel that history is repeating itself? And I feel it is. I feel like we're back in like we're back on post 9/11 right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is weird if you really look at what's going on around everywhere with the fashions and the music.
Right.
Like, definitely been very 90s.
Very, 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 very goddamn 90s again. I'm wondering what time period I'm in. I mean, they just claim to have found out who murdered Tupac. So I'm like, what year are we in?
Yeah, it's very 90s like, which, you know, the 90s came just before 9/11, right? So we do seem to be on like some weird kind of cycle. I don't think it's like complete repeat yourself. Like, I don't think it's like circular.
Yes.
Right? Or a loop. I think it's more spiral in nature, like, or vortice like in nature. So, like, it will circle back around again, either a little wider or a little tighter. And it'll feel similar and smell similar and look similar, but a few things will be different, right? And those few things will be, you know, sort of that are different will be sort of the thing that allows a person's pattern matching, no matter how good it is, to not quite catch on to what's happening before it happens, right? Like, type of thing. You know, it's very... If you ever listened to Terrence McKenna, who I'm certainly very well familiar with
I interviewed his brother, by the way.
Right. And the suspicions around Terrence McKenna and his brother, I'm not saying that there's no fishy stuff at the deli.
Well, let's be honest. There's something a little off about them. I'm not quite sure what it was, but there's something there. I don't know what exactly it means, though.
That said, like, Terrence McKenna gave lots of interesting talks and had lots of interesting ideas and was a fantastic storyteller.
Do you think he worked for the feds?
I think that, like, I don't know that he was sitting there going, all right, I'm going to do this for the feds.
Right.
I'm 100% certain that at some point his social sphere and his mind were penetrated by intelligence, and willingly or unwillingly, he, you know, was swayed sometimes. And at a certain point, he probably became aware of it and wasn't quite sure what to do about it. And in his own way, probably tried to manage it when, you know, manage it and not allow it to completely destroy the part, you know, his work. But at a certain point when that's happened to you, you then don't even know where you were led astray. So are you even dealing with good material or whatnot? And I don't think he, you know, he doesn't seem the personality type who would come out and say, hey, look, I was fooled. And so therefore you may have been led down the wrong path as well. But I don't think he did a lot of things. And he doesn't strike me as someone who like would enjoy being in on leading people down the garden path, but he does strike me as someone who, if he figured out that's what happened, might not say anything. Right. Like that's sort of my best analysis. I can't say for sure one way or another. There's other people who, you know, it's easier for me to believe are in on it. Now, I'm also, I think it's also fair to say, well, Emily, you like a lot of the things Terrence McKenna says, and so it's going to be harder for you to believe that he might be a bad guy. And that's possible too. I consider it from all the angles, right? Like, right. I look at things from many different perspectives, and I always have a healthy dose of skepticism and a healthy dose of optimism, and I try to balance those things. But nonetheless, he had very interesting ways of describing things. And there was one talk he gave where he was like sitting at a computer at a desk, and he was explaining the evolution of novelty to somebody, right? And he was talking about time would speed up. And eventually, like, you know, that basically fashions, like hemlines would rise and fall to the same rhythm that civilizations rose and fall in the past. And it would all be part of the same sort of circle or spiral or, you know, sort of history repeating itself kind of thing, right? It's all part right. of that same, like, spiral or vortex that I had talked about. And it was so eloquent the way that he explained it, right? That it was like the same thing that was causing those things to happen. And I think it's that, right? Like, I think that, you know, I don't know necessarily like what's the chicken and what's the egg, or what's the start point and what's the end point, or sure. if they're one and the same or whatever it is. But, you know, it's some sort of fascinating like spiral or sort of infinity loop that is sort of like hyperdimensional that we live in and that we sort of move around in. And it gives us the impression that we're moving sort of forward and that time is linear. But I actually think it's more sort of spiral or spherical and sort of curves back on itself and revisits certain ideas only so you can extrapolate like a different perspective on it and then move forward with that. And, you know, so I think it's part of the way that nature and reality and the universe and time sort of unfolds and unfolds itself.
I'm also going to say something here that's a little unsavory, but, you know, I think he was also a bit of a creep.
It's possible.
I think he kind of was. He just comes across a little creepy at times. And for those who don't know, he's an ethnobotanist, by the way, a mystic of sorts, a shaman of sorts, and a very intelligent guy, I may add. But there was that creepy element to it for the man, if you've ever met him in person. And I know a few people who have, and he was a little off. Aren't they all?
Yeah, I mean, I've never met him in person. I know some people who have, right? And I, you know, I haven't listened to or followed him as closely as some people, but I did listen to some talks and lectures of his at a very specific time in my sort of development in terms of like how I understand the world and, you know, how I internalize experiences. And I found some of the ways that he describes things and some of the way that he sort of synthesizes information from different realms to be intriguing. And you know that,
right?
But I also know that like people who do a lot of, you know, psychedelics can develop some oddities and
be
very paranoid and can be in, like, you know, like I don't love all the people that I meet at parties or that I, you know, certainly like I think there's a lot of people there that I find a little bit weird.
That's
and I'm
right.
sure they find me to be weird or whatever it is, right? So I think he's was, you know, a man who is imperfect, like all of us are. And I think that, you know, I guess like the difference between, I don't know you, I'm just meeting you today, right? We've all made mistakes in our life. We've been fooled.
Right.
Right. We've done dumb stuff.
All I'm saying is I would never let him babysit my kids if I ever had them.
Oh, no, never. Well, no.
If I had kids. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I wouldn't let him babysit my kids. I don't have any kids, but if I had kids, I wouldn't let him babysit my dog.
Exactly. I wouldn't leave him around small animals or anything, is what I'm saying. God bless his soul, though. I mean, he opened a lot of windows, a lot of doors. But yeah, there's been a lot of unsavory things about the man, but I'm not going to get into that. He's nothing like another person out there who I actually admired and liked at one time, and that would be Hunter S. Thompson. You know, I've always liked Hunter S. Thompson for the longest time, but then you later find out about the guy, and there's a lot of things that are beyond creepy about this gentleman. But it gets even weirder. I mean, I knew a channeler of sorts, Emily, and she was telling me that she was channeling Hunter S. Thompson, and he was going to her to communicate with me through her. That's
Hunter S.
crazy.
Hunter S. Thompson was going to a channeler that you said Emily. Were you just talking to me, or was her name Emily?
No. I was just talking to you.
Okay. Okay, because you said the way you said it, I wasn't sure if you were meant to.
Sorry, I didn't mean to confuse you.
So Hunter S. Thompson was going to a channeler to communicate with you.
No. His dead spirit was communicating through this channeler. For some reason, he kept coming to her and relaying messages to me. It was the strangest thing.
Interesting.
I don't know what to make of that.
I don't know enough about you to make sense of that or whatnot. But
I don't either.
You're not the first person who's told me something like that, like not about Hunter S. Thompson, right? But I certainly have had very strange interactions in the realms with and in the regular physical reality that we all share here.
Right.
That seemed beyond the pale and very inexplicable to me. And I've had many people report very strange experiences,
right?
So I think one of the things that happens is as we become increasingly aware of how strange this place we live is, right? Others who've had the same specific unique, like sometimes you just have a weird thought, right? Like, where did this one come from? And back to this one is so weird, I might not even ever tell anyone else because people would think I was crazy that I thought that, right?
Right.
But we live in this system that seems to be aware of when we have an insight. And once let's just say you had some unique insight or moment of awareness of something bizarre about the place that we live or the nature of the human experience. And maybe he'd had that as well. It almost like fires off an alarm for the one or two or five other people that have ever had that thought or that feeling or not. And it sets up this sort of connection, like this sort of etheric connection. And then they want to try and communicate. And sometimes these are people who are living with us, but it seems weird that they would know us. And other times there are people that are gone, that are past, or people that are spirits that we don't even know that these people ever existed. Like, we're all really just looking for connection and understanding, and it comes sometimes from directions and places and people and realms that you're not expecting it from. So that's not the first time I've heard something like that.
It's just very, very strange. And I'm wondering if it was a real synchronicity or an artificial synchronicity.
You mean a controlled coincidence?
Perhaps. I mean, you could also call it that. It's just, I think there are artificial synchronicities out there that are kind of made to target certain individuals.
Yeah, I mean, this is a multi-layered onion, right? Like, this is an ongoing topic of conversation between myself and one of my co-hosts, Michael Wan, and the people who sort of are part of the project that we've been doing for the last 2.5 or 3 years, right? Like, you know, there are synchronicities, there are coincidences, and then there are arranged, you know, things that are clearly just, you know,
a bait and switch. Yeah, a bait and switch, in other words, where
arranged.
You know, a group of people could have the same idea, but again, it's a bait and switch where you're led down the wrong rabbit hole.
So I think there's like a variety of different levels and layers to each of those that I delineated. And then there's like blended kinds of things. You know, we pretty early on when we started tracking and studying synchronicity, we fell onto a lot of the work by John Lilly. And he had this idea he had this document that he created called Echo. And he talked about the Earth Coincidence Control Network or operation, right? Where basically there were certain kinds of coincidences that were being controlled for you. And once you understood how that worked, then you would be tasked with controlling the coincidences of others, right? And I don't know if this was something he liked it was more an idea he came across in his ventures with psychedelics and whatnot, right? So I think there's lots of things at play, and I think that it's no, like, there's not a one right answer, right? We all obviously know that when we talk about something and then our phone shows us an ad for that, that is not a coincidence or synchronicity, right? But there's other types that are deeper, more meaningful, that run the gamut from completely manufactured to completely natural and special. And then there's like a million varieties in between. And it's hard sometimes to know how to feel about some of these occurrences. But it's fascinating to sort of explore.
Absolutely. And of course, there's like phone telepathy, by the way. It's you already have someone in your mind and all of a sudden they call you or text you.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty trippy shit, right?
I mean, I think one of the things that's happening, let me see if I can, like, this was something I was talking about a few months back and it was super clear in my mind, but I haven't thought about it in a while. And sometimes, like, you know, like there's the fog.
The brain fog, right.
Right. But then there's also like the flu brain fog. So let me see if I can explain this in a catchy and clever way here.
No worries. You gotta
fight. All of the technology mimics the humans and the universe, right? Like they play this cool trick on us where they've convinced us to communicate with each other by telling people we have downloads, which would make us sound like we're like computers. But really they have built computers to mimic things that our brains, our bodies, our consciousness, and our environment do, right? So if they're building technologies that are modeled after our bodies or our brains or our neural networks or whatever, and those technologies communicate with each other, and they're very similar to us, right? Then we would be picking up some of that information as well. So it might not be that their idea is to control us, is to do that as a thing of control, right? But if they have the technologies that are doing machine learning or network learning or are trading information back and forth, and they are modeled to work similar to the way we work, then we would be picking up a lot of that information that's going back and forth as well.
Ah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but right. It makes sense that if you're building something to mimic something else, and that thing you're mimicking is also going to learn the things that the things you built to mimic it learn.
In other words, you're not excited for AI.
I don't think about it a lot. It's not, I'm not as paranoid about it as some other people.
Some people are extremely paranoid by it, by the way, except, you know, with all the robots being made, basically to get rid of all the workers out there, people are losing their minds.
Yeah, I don't think about it very much, and I don't use like ChatGPT. I don't like sign up for all the new art generator, AI, ChatGPT, let your, you know, computer run your business for you. Like, I don't sign up for all that stuff.
Right.
And I also look at like how inefficient Like, we have all of this tech and we're supposed to be terrified because everything is a police state and a surveillance state and AI is going to take over and this, that, and the other thing. But like, there's so much inefficiency and, you know, like all these new things that they come up with, or half of them, more than half of them, are failures.
Yeah, that's right? Another thing. They don't really work as well as you think they do.
Nothing really works. And if you go like outside of your bubble, right? Like, I was just in Mexico for a vacation, and like most places there, like the cell phone doesn't even work half the places you go.
Right.
Wi-Fi is weak. The cell towers are still 2G or 3G. You can't listen to a live stream. You might be able to listen to a short YouTube video. So how like an all-encompassing AI takeover is going to take place when that's the case is a mystery to me. Like, I was just, you know, I happened to arrive in Cabo San Lucas when a hurricane was hitting, right? Like, we arrived there on Friday afternoon, or wow, midday Friday. The hurricane hit sort of Friday night and through Saturday. And then by Sunday, it started clearing up and we got to enjoy the rest of our vacation. We had to stay, you know, in the hotel room for a day and a half. And at some points there was like no power or no internet or whatever it is. But this was a place where like, they're not even used to getting rain there, like anything more than a drizzle. So like, they didn't know what to do. And like a week later, even though everything was back open, like a lot of places still didn't have cable TV or internet backup or anything like that. So whether the storm is created by, you know, HARP or chemtrails or natural or whatever it is, their AI takeover is not very efficient if the things that it would run on can't be immediately re-erected after their created storm passes through, right?
I agree, so, yeah.
I used to get scared about this stuff, like a lot, right? Like when I was living in downtown Los Angeles and at the height of my drug use and at the depth of my conspiracy research and you know, was just absolutely completely awash in the paranoia that goes along with having hit the bottom of the rabbit hole, right? I was terrified at that point that there was going to be a tsunami, because that you were hearing all this stuff about like a go global coastal event. Remember this when Cliff High used to talk about this back in like 2011 or 2012,
oh,
and
yeah,
that, you know, the oceans were going to rise and whatever it was, right? And so like, I remember calculating how many miles it was from the beach to my apartment downtown Los Angeles. And I was living on the 11th floor. So I was like, okay, well, at least if there was some sort of wave, I'm kind of high up. And I was thinking about all this stuff, right? And then Larry Ellison bought a ton of property in Malibu, right? And Larry Ellison owns Oracle, which is a, you know, sort of predictive type of software, right? If the entire, he bought like almost like a huge portion of Malibu. Like, this is not a person who's going to want to lose his investment.
Right.
So if that thing was going to disappear, he wouldn't have just bought all of that. Right. So I'm pretty sure there's not going to be a global coastal event anytime soon. And I started to really like, whenever there's a fear porn campaign around, right, something like that now, I go and I look and I see whose investments would be harmed if that were to happen. And when I see that, like, those people who are also, those people like are also the ones who are like creating the technologies to see into, it just doesn't make any sense, right? Like, I just don't get that scared anymore of that kind of thing, right? You can't,
right,
create a scenario where like the people that you are, the people that you are harvesting for energy or profits are going to disappear, but you're still only interested in harvesting. It just doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't.
Right?
And I'm glad you brought up Cliff High, by the way. You know, he's also someone who's been on, been here on the program, but I haven't talked to him in many years. And, you know, I forgot all about that. He was one of the individuals pushing that narrative that the oceans were going to rise and all this was going to happen. I recall that, and, you know, he's someone who goes after other people for making false promises and, you know, throwing that narrative out there. And I guess he forgot that he was one of them.
So, like, I also have done, I did about four or five shows with Cliff High many years back, right? And I had my own personal experience sort of with Cliff High that is, I think, informed how I sort of feel about him. I'm mostly humored by him, right? I have a hard time taking him seriously. He was always very nice to me. I'll put it that way. He was always very nice to me, right? And I enjoyed the conversations I had with him because they brought some interesting ideas forward, whether they're valid or not.
Right.
He has said a lot of things that just absolutely were nonsense and didn't turn out to be true. But he also, a couple of times, has said or predicted things that, like, well, damn, that was a pretty good one. Like, during that same period of time where he was predicting the global coastal event, he also talked about the fact that there was going to be some kind of weird sun disease and people would lose their mind and go batshit. Well, we got coronavirus, right?
That's true.
And the corona is the sun, and people did lose their minds and go batshit. And, right, it was kind of, you know, like, so he's a very mixed bag, right? And he, you know, I don't trust him. I'm humored by him.
We still like him, but we don't trust him.
That's exactly right. You know, he requested to be on my show. Right. Like he wanted to be on our
on
show.
Show.
And so,
okay.
It was when I was still working with Randy, my good friend, Randy Moggins, who I did Off Planet Radio with for a number of years. Right. And he wanted to talk specifically with us based on some things that Randy had said about some things that were going on in the alternative media at that time. And then also he wanted to talk about time. And he felt like,
wait, who's Randy?
Randy Moggins, he was my co-host on Off Planet Radio. He's
Okay.
I would say that it was when I first found Randy Moggins back a long time ago when his show was not called Off Planet Radio and it was called Exotica. When I first found his show, I think it was about sometime around 2009. That was when I stepped into like a very deeper, weirder understanding of what was really going on here that defied not just conventional norms, but also conspiracy norms and counterpolitic norms, and really started to looking at some of the strange interplay between realms that was kind of really shaping and molding what was happening that allows people, even people who consider themselves to be outside the box thinkers or conspiratorial in their mindset or whatever, to be easily fooled and led down paths that will, you know, burn a lot of calories and waste a lot of time, but not get them any closer to what's really going on. And I learned a lot from him, both before I was a co-host with him and then while I was a co-host and as a friend. And I would not be here doing this if he hadn't given me my opportunity to start. But
with that said.
I thought you were gonna
drop a bomb here on me.
Oh, no, no. I love Randy.
Oh, okay. I was like, shit.
Cliff wanted to talk to us about time. Time was one of the main things. Randy and I talked a lot about mind control, a lot about time and dimensional travel. And, you know, we talked about just different stuff than most people were talking about at that time. And so Cliff wanted to talk to us about time. So we did probably 3 or 4 shows with him. And at a certain point, like, when you're not kind of going along with what Cliff wants to, so where he wants to steer the conversation, he kind of loses interest. And at a certain point, like, I think Randy and I started pushing back on some of the things he was saying, and then he disappeared and we never heard from him again. Like, we had a show scheduled, canceled, you know, and his wife wasn't well or something, which I know other people who, when he was no longer interested in doing shows with them, or when one of his predictions about crypto hadn't really quite panned out or whatever, they would get a similar kind of email. And then I never heard from him again, right? Which is fine. Like, you know, everybody's doing the thing the way they're doing it and whatever. I think he's a good, everybody has to have like their sort of Alex Jones learning experience and their Cliff High learning experience and their whoever their thought leader is for a period of time or someone that they're captivated by. Right. And he provides a level of learning and discernment for people. Right. And so I'm humored mostly by him. And he was always very nice to me. So it is what it is. But I feel the same way that that you do. I don't follow him anymore. I stopped following him about that time that we stopped hearing from him. But I know I hear things, you know, from other people about whatever he's talking about, you know, and so I assume he's kind of always doing the same thing. And it's kind of like a broken clock is right twice a day. And some of those rights are pretty clever. So
I haven't talked to him. Right. I haven't talked to him since probably 2017. I haven't checked in on him, but
that was
I know.
The same time as me. The same time for me.
Yeah. It's been many, many moons. I hope he's well, though. I'm sure he's fine.
He seems to be. He's still out there kicking, so.
Yeah, he's good. No harm, no foul. And you mentioned time travel. I didn't even know he was talking about time travel at any period in
He wasn't talking timeline. About time travel. He wanted to talk to us about time.
Oh, about time.
Yeah, right? So time was always sort of the ability to manipulate time, our relationship with time, whether we are controlled by time or whether we control time, were topics Randy and I had played around with for years. And so I think when he wanted to talk about time, like that was part of why he wanted to talk to us about it, right? Uh-huh. Randy and I did get into time and dimensional travel a little bit, but that was something that over the course of about the time that I started working with Michael Wan, which was in 2020, it was like right at the beginning of COVID, like time and dimensional travel started to become like a major theme in all of my work, and it's still is.
It's a good talking point. You know, I was more along the lines thinking of like time travel, like something, you know, like Andrew Bashago talks about.
Yeah, I've spoken with, Andrew Bashago. So this was actually one of the topics that we talked about with Cliff, right? So one of the things that Randy, Cliff, and I we're all in agreement about is that Andrew Bashago is telling the truth. Andrew Bashago is not a liar.
Right.
But Andrew Bashago is misunderstanding some of his experiences. I did about a 4-hour show.
I'm gonna have to watch that because I'm supposed to talk to him over the phone tomorrow. By the way, he might be a guest here shortly. I'm scheduled to do a little rendezvous with him and see what's going on.
Would you like to hear about my history and my experience with Andrew Bashago?
Absolutely. I want you to provide 8x10s for me here for the show so I could ask him. Joking, of course, but yes, go ahead, lay it on me.
So first of all, I don't know if he'll remember me or not, but when you talk to him, tell him I say hello and I hope he's well. And I haven't spoken to him in years, so I'd love to speak with him again sometime.
I'll let him know what's going on. Yeah, I could try to rearrange that with him, with you.
Yeah. So we did about a 4-hour show with him. And Randy had done shows with him before then, and then I think he's done shows with him since then. But I was part of about a 3 or 4 hour show with him. And then the conversation continued after for a few hours, right? Andrew Bashago is from the same town outside of Los Angeles that I'm from. We went to the same high school, and we had a number of the same mysterious experiences as children. Andrew Bashago is a bit older than me, but we literally grew up in the same neighborhood. I think Andrew is mistaken. I think that what he experienced was more akin to mind control and to the extent than that he actually went to Mars per se. I think he experienced some combination of mind control and possibly techniques or technologies that would provide the experience that might be known as something more like, you know, temporal movement or dimensional movement, something like that, right? Time travel, dimensional travel. Like, I don't think he traveled to a location that is we would know as Mars. That's just my opinion. I'm not saying that because that's what I think.
I hear you.
Right? Right? And he also, so he claims to have been to Mars, right, through an elevator down off the in Los Angeles. Right. And I understand the kind of movement that he's talking about that took place in the elevator that he explains. And he also claims to have jumped from New Jersey to New Mexico, I think. right? So
something like that, yeah.
So he's talking about number of different kinds of movement through space, right? And then he's also explained some things about, I don't know if he would call it time travel, but sort of like looking into the future, right? So I think he is reporting his experiences. He's telling the truth about what he believes he experienced. I just think he is misunderstanding how advanced some sort of mind control and technologies and things like that were, right? So you're able to very easily clip some of the interviews with him, and he sounds, you know, they always like to make him sound crazy, right? I don't think he's crazy. I think he just, you know,
he experienced something.
He 100%. He experienced something. He's telling the truth about what he thinks he experienced. And in my opinion, and the only, like, I will just be straight with you. Like, I've experienced many similar things to what Andrew has experienced, but I don't think that I have been to Mars.
I think
that I run through exercises to make me believe that I've been through two places that I have. There's two possibilities: that I've been through sort of some sort of like spiritual or a hypnotic or mind control type of experience.
Or planted memory of sorts.
Or even just like you're traveling sort of in your mind, like an etheric or astral experience that felt
too.
So real, you believe it's real. Mm-hmm. That. Or the other thing is, I do think that the area that he and I grew up in, I do think there is something unusual there in the ground, something that is akin to some type of like portal or connection between layers of reality, right? And I do think from that location, it's possible to experience other versions of reality, okay? But they're not far away. Like they're not, you're not going somewhere else. You're just sort of reconfiguring yourself to another, something else that's right here, but at a different frequency, right? So part of the reason that I knew that I believe he's telling the truth, like for myself, is that he was able to confirm some things for me, some strange experiences that I've had. And he knew exactly what I was talking about, right? Like both, like I have always had this memory of this weird roller skating rink
right.
in Chatsworth, and I could never find where it was. And he knew exactly what I was talking about and where it was, right? Because he had been there as well. He also informed me of something that I did not know at that point, and that the further I dig into this and it connects to so many things, the more interesting it looks. And that is that Ayn Rand used to live in Chatsworth, and that, you know, she used to, like, I basically, like, from the time I was a young teenager, Atlas Shrugged has been my favorite book, and I had a very different perception of that book and what it means than most people do. And he starts telling me that when he used to work at the 76 station on the corner of Devonshire and Mason, I know it's hilarious, the names of the streets there,
yeah.
right? That Ayn Rand used to come in and say really weird shit to him, almost like she was like a handler or a controller or something like that, right? So I did not know that Aunt Ayn Rand had lived in Chatsworth. It turns out she lived in Chatsworth while she was writing Atlas Shrugged. And it is my opinion that Atlas Shrugged is actually about Chatsworth. When you look into where she lived when she was living there, what she was doing and the things she had to say, and you kind of understand some of the things that I understand about Chatsworth and some of the ways that I perceived her book, it's like, oh, okay, there's something there. I had no idea about that. He's the one who told me about that when I explained how obsessed with Ayn Rand I had. And he's like, what are you, right? He lived the gas station that he's talking about that he was working at, that she used to come in and do that, was literally like, you could, you know, if you had a good arm, you could throw a baseball from my house and hit that gas station, right? So the amount of weird things that were going on in that area in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, and still now, right? But that we're talking about the time frame where he was affected by it. He also went to UCLA, as did I, as did my parents, right? And, you know, so I have a lot of things in common with him, and there is a fair amount of overlap from some of the experiences that he reports and experiences that I myself have had. I just have a different perception of what was happening. Now, I'm also a bit younger, right? And I have grown up with certain ideas and technologies that he didn't, or that weren't publicly known then, right? So, you know, he may have taken things more literally than we would take things now, because we understand how some of the sausage is made in a different way than they understood in the 60s and 70s, right? But I found him to be very kind, and there was not a bone in my body that thought he was telling me something that wasn't true, right?
Understood,
I just think that, like, there's a different way to perceive the things he reports, and that those can match up to a lot of things that would provide a lot of evidence for a lot of things that are going on in the world.
Absolutely. And that's crazy that we had a synchronicity right here. You know, I had no idea that you even knew of Andrew at all. I just threw his name out there, and then look what happened.
People say that once they come around me, the synchronicities start happening fast and furious. Like, people will report things like, I was watching a show that you did, that you posted 2 weeks ago. And while I was watching the show, my girlfriend was in the other room reading. And she came out of the room because at the same moment you said whatever, some sentence, she'd read the same sentence in the book she was reading. Right?
That's
like
wild.
That there seems to be some syncing up, right, that happens. And she, like, that girlfriend in the other room doesn't listen to my show or care about what I'm talking about, right? But it happens even for that. So I don't know what that is. Now, if you know, sometimes with the synchronicities, sometimes I wonder, are we generating them or are we attracted to them? Are we like what's causing it, right? So is there do I say something that then makes something happen, or is something about to happen that I can feel, and therefore I say it, like I say it because it's, I can, there's this sense of it's impending, right? So we've played a lot with that. So I don't know if there's this natural like syncing up of like energies around specific ideas or terms or phrases or whatever it is, right? I don't know exactly how it works. I've been playing with this for a couple of years, and while I've learned a lot, I can't honestly tell you I'm any closer to knowing what the truth is about the role that synchronicity plays in our existence. But there's a really good book called Synchronicity by F. David Peet that can help people understand sort of how synchronicity is part of the underlying nature of our reality.
Right. I just think the universe is sort of all embedded into another layer of another layer upon another layer. And somehow these things sort of connect like magnets of sorts. It's like a brand new sort of a physics that we have yet to really determine how the hell it even works, in my opinion.
I agree.
I don't even think Jung even understood it, as far as I remember.
Jung is talked about in this book, and David Bohm, and a lot of people who've done lots of work in philosophy and in physics, and how those things coalesce around synchronicity. But yeah, it's definitely it's a fascinating topic, and I do think I agree with you. There's like
It's
something that brings together some kind of science and some kind of spirituality. When I say spirituality, I don't mean like of the like religious. I don't mean like that. Like, I don't mean that. I mean, there's some energy that comes from within us that matches up to the way physics and chemistry and biology and things like that work, that create this sort of blended, right? It's kind of like a fusion type of thing, right? Fusion is one of the things I really like to talk about. But
right. You know what that reminds me of also is the work of Eve Lorgan, by the way, in terms of like, you know, she had talked about how there's people that, you know, they've witnessed a UFO, or they've been abducted, and, you know, they go to these events, and both of these people sort of connect with each other like no other. And then they get led down to a strange sort of relationship of sorts.
Right. The love bite. The love alien bite. Love. Yeah.
Right. I love Eve Lorgan, by the way. Also a regular here at times.
I'm familiar with who she is and that idea. I'm not deeply familiar with her material. I've never spoken with her, but it's certainly
you'll love her.
Out in the community for, you know, a number of years.
Oh, yeah. you would love her, by the way.
So I don't go to UFO conferences for that reason. I don't want to get bit by
right. Yeah, you don't want to get
kidding.
It.
I'm just kidding. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Emily, I must say, time flew by here, and you know, there's so many other things I would love to talk to you about, but we are against time here, as usual. Time is never on our side, as you know, but I do want to thank you for spending some time with me here and sharing your thoughts and opinions and being as open as you have been here. My audience loves that sort of thing, and they're going to love you once they hear this.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure to spend a little bit of time with you, and hopefully we'll do it again sometime.
Oh, absolutely. We'll do round two. And Emily, please feel free to plug anything you'd like here before you go. And you can leave us with some final words if you want, or you can just say, I'm out of here, and give us an Irish goodbye, as they say.
Well, if people are intrigued, like, as you said, my YouTube channel is Emily Moyer. There are hundreds of videos there. I don't post that much long form stuff. I'm not posting too much there these days, but sometimes I do a public show. But you can find my work. I have a website, emilycmoyer.com. You can find links to all my content there. I'm on patreon.com. That's still like the old Off Planet Media Patreon, but it's patreon.com/offplanetmedia. EmilyMoyer.locals.com, and I'm also on rockfin.com/EmilyMoyer. I have different varieties of material that are available in different places, and I do often make some of the content public on Rockfin or Locals, so for free, right, after my supporters have gotten it, so people can go there and sample it for free and whatnot. I also always offer free promo codes for, I have a variety of different communities on Locals, so people can check out my material. I'm also a nutrition consultant. I come at it from kind of a little bit more esoteric of a perspective. And I also do storytelling sessions with people. So if you want to talk about weird shit, you can come do that with me. Yeah, I don't know. So people are intrigued. They can find my work there. I have hundreds of hours of being on other people's shows. I'm kind of talking all the time. So, yeah, I don't know. We live in really interesting times. It feels like pretty chaotic and a little bit heavy right now. But it's definitely not boring to be alive. And I guess one of the things I'm really kind of into right now is just, starting to, none of us who are here listening to you or talking to you, obviously are buying the mainstream narrative or probably even like layer one or layer two of conspiracy or counter narrative or whatever it is. But I've been really digging into the idea of like how much time we have spent with some of these conspiracies, and like we're still talking about some of them,
right?
Like 20 or 25 years later, right? And like what have, if something is trying to be obscured, how much work has been done on the thing that's really trying to be obscured while we've been chasing down clues on 25-year-old mysteries, right?
Good point. And
in my opinion, most of the things that are going on that they're trying to keep us distracted from with politics, with like the social issues and all of that kind of stuff, really have to do with advances in power and genetics and how those things relate to temporal and dimensional control. Let's just put it that way, right? And war, political chaos, pandemic, famine, inflation, you know, Pizzagate type things keep us busy, like looking for like whether people's shoes match and, you know, digging out all kinds of weird arcane information. But very few people that I know in this realm have really like spent a lot of time looking into advances that have been made in genetic engineering, nuclear fusion, and what those things have to do with the way we move through the reality and the realms that we are in. And I actually think that like that's where the big kahuna is. And if we can be distracted away from understanding how those physics and those metaphysics work by something like a school shooting or whether Hillary Clinton has a boot on or something like that,
right,
then they have all the time in the world to advance themselves while we do that stuff. So I spend less time with that these days than I used to. They're fascinating topics at nuclear fusion, genetic engineering, DNA, all of this kind of stuff. And it's hard to understand, but not as hard as people think it is. And probably a better use of our time than deconstructing all the conspiracy of the day, right?
I agree. I mean, some people could connect dots with anything to justify whatever batshit idea they have in their heads.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, but that's... people don't like to give you the truth just like you did here today, and I think people will appreciate that. So once again, thank you so much, Emily, for that, and we'll do it again on the other side.
Thank you, Michael. Have a wonderful evening.
And welcome back, boys and girls, for another special edition of the Michael Deacon Program. Joining me in a moment, we have new blood. My guest will be Emily Moyer. She is a multifaceted professional serving as a nutrition consultant, life coach, and podcast host with a knack for blending unique life experiences, intuitive research, and analytical approach. She explores unconventional ideas from various domains, including alternative cyberspace, the arts, health, sports, and human development. Her podcasts offer fresh perspectives and concepts for our ever-evolving understanding. Now, without further ado, let's get down to business and bring in Emily. And there she goes, boys and girls. That was our guest for this evening. We were joined by Emily Moyer, and definitely go check out her show by searching Emily Moyer on YouTube or wherever you get podcasts. I hope you enjoyed that one. And of course, much love and respect to all of you new subscribers out there. And of course, those of you who want bonus material, please go to patreon.com/Michael Deacon or go to michaeldeacon.com and get yourself some merchandise. There's some awesome t-shirts there. There's a beer mug there, a giant pint, an Amber Heard size pint for you. And of course, the Thug Life Trump t-shirt, which I love, by the way, looks amazing. Don't be shy now. And we've launched a forum, basically a message board in other words, but you can hang out with me and Mike and other listeners just like yourself. Sign up today, michaeldeacon.com. And with that said, the world is a mysterious place, and life itself is a mystery. Until next time, mahalo.